I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a follow-up to the last episode on the JFK assassination. This will likely be the only other episode you hear where I tackle the assassination as my main topic of the discussion. And like I said in the last episode, that's mainly because I really am ill-equipped to discuss the assassination. For me, it's a quagmire. There are so many opposing views, so many different facts, and all kinds of things that people will discuss, and I just don't have the expertise. Now, initially, I had wanted to do a debate between someone like Fred Litwin, who really dismisses the idea of a conspiracy, and someone from the opposing side that Oswald wasn't a lone assassin and that the Warren Commission didn't get the full truth of what occurred in Dallas on November 23rd, 1963. A few different people found out that I had wanted to do this debate because I had put fillers out, essentially. One of them was Jim DiEugenio, who is a previous guest on the program. Interestingly, Jim and I have never covered the assassination in depth on my program, even though that is his specialty. That was by design. I think Jim offers some very interesting perspectives on issues related to foreign policy and Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers, etc., etc. But I did not want to deal with the assassination because, as I have said repeatedly now, it's just not a topic that I know enough about. But I said, hey, if I'm gonna have someone on to talk about it that believes it was just Oswald, I, you know, probably should allow someone to give the opposing viewpoint. And I really had wanted to do this as a debate. That fell through, and, you know, Jim wanted to give a counterpoint. And I said, okay, let's do that then. Now, I have to be honest, I've been friendly with Jim. He's been on the program a few times before. I hope I don't come off as, you know, completely partial. I think on issues related to the Kennedy assassination theories and attempts to connect it to QAnon, I had strong opinions about that, especially when it came to Fred Litwin's sort of view that the original sort of Kennedy assassination critics of the Warren Commission were sort of like a prototype for the Donald Trumps and Alex Joneses and QAnons of today. I disagree with that, and my opinion on that isn't going to change, likely, unless someone really makes a case for maybe why I should. I believe that there's a much greater connection between the John Birch Society and QAnon than there is between QAnon and someone like Mark Lane, who was an early critic of the Warren Commission. The other thing that I may be more partial on in this conversation is the issue of JFK foreign policy in Vietnam, because I do feel like there has been reputable people that have raised questions about plans for a withdrawal under Kennedy. And those people in particular are John Newman, author of JFK in Vietnam, and also Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and James K. Galbraith. And from my purview, there should at least be discussion about that, right? I mean, I've seen Galbraith and Rick Perlstein actually go back and forth debating this issue, and I think that's okay. I think we should have debate. But I don't think the view should be dismissed entirely out of hand. And a lot of the beginning of this conversation deals with that issue of JFK and foreign policy in Vietnam. So I think in general, when it came to the assassination itself, I'm a bit in the dark about a lot of the things Jim and Fred were talking about, particularly Kerry Thornley. I do not have as strong opinions on Thornley either way, and I'm actually more familiar with Thornley for his involvement with the pranksterish religion known as Discordianism. But, like I said, I don't really know all the details of the Garrison case, and I didn't really question either Fred or Jim much about their views on the case. I just sort of let them have their say. And again, this is one of the reasons I felt I was really ill-equipped to do a show tackling specifically the Kennedy assassination, because I am no expert and I'm not a huge researcher into that topic. So part of me kind of thinks that maybe I shouldn't have even delved into the Kennedy assassination for an episode of Parallax Views. Nonetheless, I did. So, you know, sometimes you gotta go out on a limb and try something different. And that's what I did with these two episodes. The reason this wasn't released earlier is because I wanted to release them both at the same time. So that's why there was no Monday episode this past week. Anyways, here is my conversation with Jim DiEugenio. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Beer knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome back to Parallax Views. Jim DiEugenio of Kennedys and King. How are you doing, Jim?
Good evening. Nice to be here again.
So, Jim, we were planning for a while to have a debate between you and Fred Litwin, who has a book out, On the Trail of the Assassins. I just interviewed him, and ultimately, he did not want to do a debate. And I decided, well, I'm going to have Jim back on to respond to the episode I did with Fred, because I think, you know, that's only fair. I'm not a JFK expert. I want to get both sides of the equation. So you have had a chance to listen to the interview. What do you want to get on right out of the chute here?
Okay, first of all, the name of his book is On the Trail of Delusion.
Right. You know what? I meant On the Trail of Delusions. I don't know. Right. Jim Garrison's rolling in his grave.
Right. Okay. Well, we could spend at least a couple of hours on this, all right? I sort of feel like the guy with the shovel and garbage pail after the horse parade. Okay, so, but let's talk. Let's start it off with the whole thing about Vietnam. All right. One of the things that he said was that Jim Garrison began this whole thing about Kennedy getting out of Vietnam. Technically, that's not true. Jim Garrison was the first critic who said something about it. But if you go through Jim Garrison's files, which I've had the opportunity to do, the reason Garrison got onto this is because there's a professor at the University of Miami, Ohio, who wrote a 26-page handwritten letter, okay, to him. It was entitled something like The Death of Kennedy and the Escalation of the Vietnam War. All right. That's how this all started with Garrison. Okay. Now he says he went through Garrison's files. Okay. Well, evidently he missed that because I sure found it. But beyond that, John Newman wrote a book in 1992 called JFK in Vietnam. And that book was the basis for that segment of the film JFK. All right. Now, Newman actually co-wrote those scenes, and they're all factually based. All right. This provoked a huge debate, and the ARB, the Assassinations Record Review Board, declassified hundreds of pages on this issue. Today, it's an open and shut case with these declassified documents. All right. The most important, I believe, was the record of the May 1963 SecDef meeting in Hawaii. All right. At that meeting, McNamara flies out to Honolulu. All the major division chiefs fly into Honolulu and they have a meeting. The very first thing that McNamara brings up, or one of the very first things that McNamara brings up, is he says, I want all the withdrawal schedules handed in. Now, obviously, if you open up a meeting with that, then somehow, some way, McNamara ordered a withdrawal from Vietnam, and he did, okay? All right, and so that's why he's asking. And Harkins, who's the Pentagon chief there, had all these withdrawal schedules done and ready. He hands them to McNamara, okay? McNamara looks at the schedules and he says, this isn't fast enough. Okay. He wants it sped up. All right. Now, there's also a declassified tape that the ARB got of an October 1963 meeting at the White House with at least Kennedy, McNamara, and Bundy. On that tape, McNamara talks about the withdrawal schedules, all right? And Bundy doesn't know what he's talking about. He says words of the effect, what's that about, all right? And so McNamara says, this is a way of getting out of Vietnam. We're finding a way to get out. When McGeorge Bundy listened to that tape many years later in the 90s, when he was cooperating with Gordon Goldstein on his biography, Lessons in Disaster, he listened to it and he realized what had happened. And he told Goldstein, Kennedy went around me because he knew I was too hawkish. And so he went to McNamara, okay, in order to sidestep me. And he went on to say he had nothing but admiration for what Kennedy had done, okay, in that regard. Now, also, I'm going to give you a little bit of a scoop here. This is in the upcoming film by Oliver Stone, okay? John Newman got permission from McNamara to go down to the Pentagon and listen to his debrief exit interviews, okay? They didn't want to let him in. They didn't want to hear this stuff. So John had to call McNamara, and McNamara called the Pentagon, and he got in, all right? On those debriefs, McNamara says that me and President Kennedy had decided that we could train the Vietnamese. We could advise the Vietnamese. We could give them equipment, all right? But we couldn't fight the war for them, all right? Because if we ended up fighting the war for them, that would have meant that they lost, okay? they couldn't win the war on their own, all right? So in other words, you have all this new evidence today. There really shouldn't be any debate about this at all anymore. Kennedy was getting out of Vietnam, all right? And that's the end of the story, all right? Now, on the other end, you got Johnson, and we have tapes of this now, telling McNamara how much he disagreed with that policy. This is when he became president in February of 1964. He says words to the effect, I had to sit there and listen while you and the president talked about getting out of Vietnam. I knew how bad it was psychologically for the government there. Okay, but since I was only the vice president, I had to do it. And by the way, he even asked McNamara to take back NSAM 263. He said, find an excuse to take that back. And NSAM 263, of course, was the security memorandum which ordered the first 1,000 people to get out of Vietnam. All right. And then, of course, what happens is, slowly but surely, all of Kennedy's advisors leave. You know, Salinger leaves, Bundy leaves, you know, I think Kenny O'Donnell leaves, all right, McNamara leaves, all right, et cetera. And if you can believe it, and it's the truth, the Bundy brothers ended up helping Humphrey because they were so against what Johnson had done with Vietnam by 1967, 1968. Okay, so to me, this is an open and shut case now. You know, I don't think there's any room for debate anymore.
I just want to add to that. So for my listeners, if they're unfamiliar with John Newman's book, JFK and Vietnam, that book isn't really about the assassination. It is literally just about all of this foreign policy sort of subterfuge and what Kennedy was up against, correct?
That's correct. It's only about the whole Vietnam issue, and it takes it from 1961 to 1963, beginning of 1964. And let me recommend to your listeners that they get the updated version, okay, because there's a second version that he rewrote. I think the first version is 1992. I think the second version is 2017. Okay, that's the updated version where he adds even more documents to the case that he's making. So in my opinion, anybody who debates this issue anymore, you know, is simply sidestepping the facts. Okay, there's too many new facts that have entered the arena. And to me, it's an open and shut case today.
And I also wanted to add, I mean, I remember reading in 2013, you had Rick Perlstein saying in The Nation magazine, I believe it was, Kennedy was never going to pull out of Vietnam. There was no withdrawal plan. And then you had a response in The Nation by James K. Galbraith. And, you know, this was being discussed very seriously. I mean, James Galbraith is not, you know, some guy on the fringes of history and political commentary. This has been discussed very seriously by figures like Galbraith. I think when we look at someone like Arthur Schlesinger talked about the issue of the permanent government. I mean, we had a lot of people talking about this kind of subterfuge that was going on during the Kennedy era.
Galbraith is a professor at the University of Texas. All right. His father is John K. Galbraith. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the reason that Jamie Galbraith got into this is because what his father told him. Okay. Let me give you an example. In 1961, John Kenneth Galbraith had Nehru come into Washington because he wanted Nehru to be a go-between between Kennedy and Hanoi to negotiate an armistice, okay? All right? And Kennedy actually liked the idea. At the same time that this is happening, all right, Walt Rostow and Taylor have drafted a plan to send 8,000 troops to Vietnam. Well, John Kenneth Galbraith knew about this. He goes over to Rostow's office. He wants to see it. Rostov won't give it to him because I don't think you have the clear classification for it. Phone call comes in. Rostov turns around. John Kenneth Galbraith steals the document off his desk, takes it to back to his hotel room, reads it. He's horrified. Okay, he calls up Kennedy. He says, "You're not really going to do this, are you?" And Kennedy says, "Write me up a memo to counter it." All right. JFK postponed the showdown meeting. He brought his brother in to read the memo with him, to go over it in preparation for that meeting. Then at the meeting, whenever somebody like Rusk, say, for example, would suggest inserting combat troops, Bobby Kennedy would step forward and say, "There will not be any combat troops in Vietnam." All right. And JFK would say something like, "The only way we'll do it is if we get an alliance to go in there with us." All right. Knowing that nobody else was going to go into Vietnam with the United States. All right. And so, see, that's the line that Kennedy was not going to cross, no matter what. Okay. He was not going to insert combat troops into Vietnam. So that's why Jamie Galbraith understands this.
And I was going to say, I just looked it up. Schlesinger also wrote about the withdrawal plans. Yeah.
Right. In fact, he reviewed Newman's book on the New York Times Magazine, the New York Times book review. All right.
Yeah.
Let me add one last thing. At the trial of Daniel Ellsberg, okay, Schlesinger was one of the witnesses, and that's what he testified to, that Kennedy was not going into Vietnam. And that was back in 1973. All right.
Yeah. And I was actually going to ask about the Pentagon Papers, because we talked about the Gravel edition and why it's important to the question of JFK in Vietnam. Can we reiterate that possibly?
In my opinion, McNamara commissioned the Pentagon Papers, okay, because he realized he was going out the door, all right? He was resisting Johnson's escalations after escalation. He understood by 1967 that this was a lost cause, all right? And he understood also what Johnson had done. You know, Johnson had essentially reversed Kennedy's policy. And so he secretly commissioned this study, this epical study of how the United States got involved in Vietnam. And he kept it secret from Johnson because he knew Johnson would never approve it. All right. And so he hired all of these people that he had worked with in the Defense Department. All right. And one of them was Daniel Ellsberg. All right. And so Ellsberg, working on this thing, realized, the American people have been lied to ever since the inception of this thing. Okay. And he also said that I never had any trouble getting anything, because when I have any trouble getting anything, McNamara would just make a phone call and I would get the documents that I needed. That's how committed McNamara was to making this study. All right. And so the idea that that stupid movie, The Post, puts forward, that somehow McNamara was A, opposed to the study, and B, opposed to being open to the public, is utterly false. Okay, I believe that McNamara did this for that purpose, okay, because he had realized what had happened to American involvement there, and he wanted to give it to the public.
You know, it's interesting, too, because one of the reasons I've sort of become interested in the question of JFK and foreign policy is because I look at these figures like Galbraith and I look at figures like Schlesinger and I say, okay, you know, maybe people like Litwin would say, oh, well, they were either involved with, you know, the Kennedy administration in the case of Schlesinger, or, you know, I guess they could say, you know, James' dad was involved with Kennedy. But, you know, I don't think a Galbraith or a Schlesinger would put their reputations on the line by pushing BS. And that's what really initially got me interested in the question of JFK and foreign policy in Vietnam.
Well, see, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's been a whole new generation of writers and historians who have gone back and, based upon new research, they agreed with what Galbraith and Schlesinger wrote. And I'm talking about people like Richard Mahoney at North Carolina State, Robert Rakove at Stanford, and Philip Muhlenbeck at George Washington. They've written books about this. And they all say, well, they were right. Those guys were right with the new research. See, the other thing I objected to with Litwin, calling Kennedy a cold warrior in this day and age is, you know, it's so contra the factual record that, you know, it's almost kind of ludicrous, because if you trace Kennedy's career, what transformed John F. Kennedy was the 1951 visit to Saigon. And his visit was Seymour Topping, the reporter, and Edmund Gullion, the diplomat, because they contravened everything he'd heard from the French, you know, who said we're going to win the war, et cetera. And then he visits Topping and he visits Gullion and said, there's no way in the world the French are going to win this war. Okay. Ho Chi Minh has fired up the Viet Minh to the point that they would rather die than go back under the yoke of French colonialism. And France can't win a war like that. That's what inspired him to do this whole rethinking of his position. And this culminates in 1957 with the great Algeria speech that he makes on the floor of the Senate, where he's saying words of the effect, did we just forget what happened to us at Dien Bien Phu in 1954? And we can't see that this administration is headed down the same track in Algeria? All right, we should not be involving ourselves in something like this. We should be escorting France to the negotiating table, all right? Because what we want to do is liberate Africa, and we want to save the French nation, which had become divided over this whole Vietnam War. Then the next year, he buys 100 copies of that book, The Ugly American, and he mails it to every one of the other senators in the Senate. He then buys an ad in the New York Times. Then when he became president, he helped get the film made in Thailand. All right. Now, just watch the movie, The Ugly American, and you'll understand what the whole point of that picture is about. It essentially was saying that if all America had to offer in the third world was anti-communism, then we shouldn't even be involved. We have to stand for something more than that. And it's made in this fictional country called Sarkhan, which most people believe is Vietnam. So then when Kennedy becomes president, he starts reversing all these policies of Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles. I'll just name a couple of examples. One in Congo and another one in Indonesia. All right. The Dulles brothers had tried and overthrown Sukarno in Indonesia. Kennedy completely reversed that policy. Unbeknownst to Kennedy, the CIA was cooperating in killing Patrice Lumumba. There's a famous picture of Kennedy as president getting the news of Lumumba's death. I think it was February 13th, 1961. The CIA had kept this a secret to him. They didn't tell him about this, okay? And they had killed Lumumba, I think, on January the 17th or the 18th of that year, before Kennedy was inaugurated. That was not a coincidence. They didn't want Lumumba around when Kennedy was in office because they knew that he would support his cause. So yeah, I can go into four or five of these, but I think the point is made. Kennedy was not a classic cold warrior, all right? And I can prove this in about a dozen different ways, but let's go on to something else, okay?
So in regards to Jim Garrison, who was Jim Garrison in your view?
All right. First of all, I think Fred kind of rushed over Jim Garrison's background, okay, which is what he does in his book, all right, and he has him in the DA's office on page 2, okay? Look, Jim Garrison was an FBI agent. He got bored in the FBI. He then went ahead and went into private practice in New Orleans. at a very big time law firm. All right. There he met the mayor of the city, and the mayor of the city was very impressed with Garrison, and he offered him the supervisory capacity over the traffic court in New Orleans. Garrison took the job. He revolutionized the whole thing. He tripled the income of traffic court to the point that everybody was showing up, you know, because they knew they would get a notice to appear, and they knew they'd get double the fine if they didn't show up. He did such a good job that they offered him a judgeship over traffic court. And he said, I'd rather not do that. And he said, well, what would you rather do? I'd rather become an assistant DA. So then he becomes an assistant DA, handles all kinds of felony cases, and he does very well there. This is the kind of guy Jim Garrison was. He was the first assistant by the time the term was up. There was a dispute in the election. Garrison went ahead and redid the recount. Knowing that it would cost him his job, he said his boss actually lost. And so the new guy came into office. Now, how many people would do something like that? The answer is not too many. So then he was out of a job, and he went over to the city attorney's office. Okay. All right. So we're talking about a time span here of about 9 years, which Litwin essentially just glances over. From his city attorney's job, he didn't like the way that Richard Dowling was running the DA's office. All right. So he decided to run against him. All right. And he won. And he won the election. He did the same thing in the DA's office as he did in traffic court. He revolutionized the office. Dowling was losing 50% of his cases. Within 2 years, Garrison was winning 86% of his cases. At one stretch, right before he took on the Kennedy assassination, his office won 22 cases in a row. All right. That's how good it was. All right. So he was really a very good DA. And this gave him, because everybody supported him until he took on the Kennedy assassination, this gave him a very powerful position. He endorsed John McKeithen for governor, and McKeithen won. In 1968, McKeithen offered him to run as lieutenant governor on the ticket. Garrison declined the invitation, all right? And that would have put him in a position to become governor. But he declined it because he was too busy with the Kennedy assassination. I can tell you a really funny story about that. Okay, but let's get on to something else. All right, so that's what Garrison did.
So with regards to sort of the main thing that Fred Litwin focuses on in On the Trail of Delusions, he really hones in on this idea of propinquity and this idea that... What's that?
Time and propinquity. I think something like that.
All right. Yeah, and he sort of looks at it and says Garrison was discriminating against homosexuals. So I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that because I know you have a lot of things to say.
All right. Before I respond to that question, let me make something clear. Lyon Garrison is Jim Garrison's son. I met Lyon once or twice. I talked to him on the phone once or twice. When I went to New Orleans, I've been to New Orleans 5 times, okay? On one of my trips to New Orleans, Lyon let me copy the extant files that Jim Garrison had. So at that particular time, I think that was about 1995 or 1996, I was one of the very few people in America who actually got to go through all of Garrison's files that were available at that time. That's not all of his files, of course, because many of them were stolen. Some of them were taken to the incinerator by the guy who followed him in office, Harry Connick, who Fred Litwin thinks is a really good attorney. All right. These memos that Fred Litwin talks about and which Adam Curtis uses in his documentary, I came up with about three, maybe four. So in other words, in over 2 years, Garrison did about three of these things. Okay. Maybe four. All right. The vast overwhelming majority of information in Garrison's files were investigator memos. Okay. Either by the detective staff under him or by the attorneys or phone interviews that he did. Okay. You know, so there's maybe like three or four of those things. And so I would say you're talking about 0.01%, okay, of all, because there were literally thousands of pages, okay. 0.01% are these memos, these time and propinquity memos. That's it, okay. All the important stuff was done by the investigative staff, all right. All right, it wasn't Garrison sitting at a table and saying X went to see Y at Z's place. He lives a block from A, so then A might know Y. Okay, it wasn't that kind of stuff. Okay, all right, those were only the three or four of those in the whole thing. The vast majority is him doing research through his assistants, through his investigators, going out and interviewing certain people, okay, involved in the case. Now, Fred liked to say that the two leads that Garrison was on to in late 1963 were David Ferry and Clay Bertrand. This is what he said in his interview. It's what he says in his book. Okay. Let me make a couple comments about this. First of all, he leaves out what I think is the most important lead, which is Guy Bannister. Okay. If you recall, on the day of the assassination, Bannister was getting drunk with Jack Martin, okay, who worked in his office. They walked home, rather, to his office, and Bannister suspected that Martin was fiddling with his files, okay? And he brings up this thing about Martin gets angry and says, words of the effect, I know what was happening here this summer. Okay. Well, that's the way Oliver point in his film. It's even worse than that, because with the House Select Committee files declassified, Martin was trying to get at Oswald's file. Bannister had a file on Oswald. Okay. And when Bannister saw this, he went berserk, and Delphine Roberts, who ended up talking to the House Select Committee, Bob Burrows, says, I swear to God, if I wouldn't have intervened, I think Bannister would have killed Martin. Okay. That's how angry he got. Okay. Over Martin finding out that, you know, well, Oswald was in this office and he's being accused of killing Kennedy. All right. Well, Litwin leaves that out. Then he says that somehow, I have to chuckle at this. Garrison was searching for Clay Bertrand in November, December. No, no. It's actually ludicrous to say that, because Garrison didn't know about Clay Bertrand at that time. All right. Because the Warren Commission volumes had not been published. And then in the Warren Commission report and in the volumes, that's where this whole mystery of Clay Bertrand began. And that didn't happen until a year later. So he couldn't have been looking for Bertrand. The people who were looking for Clay Bertrand were the FBI. That's who was looking for Clay Bertrand in November and December of 1963. Because as Deke DeLoach wrote to Ramsey Clark in 1967, we had several investigatory leads into our office about Clay Shaw. And we did do an investigation of this whole Clay Shaw thing. All right. Now, there's also another memo that has been recently declassified in which the FBI knew that Shaw was Bertrand because Aaron Cohn, who was the Metropolitan Crime Commissioner manager, he told them such was the case. What's so interesting about that memo? He told the FBI Shaw was Bertrand before Garrison arrested him. Okay, this was by like a week before he was arrested. So the FBI knew that Shaw was Bertrand. Regis Kennedy actually testified in court that before he interviewed Dean Andrews.
You cut out there for a second. You said Regis Kennedy.
Regis Kennedy was an FBI agent in New Orleans. Okay. And he spoke Spanish. He was on the anti-Castro Cuban beat. Okay. He testified he was looking for Bertrand before he interviewed Dean Andrews. All right. So that's who was looking for Bertrand. Garrison didn't even know anything about this. Okay. Now let me make up a third point. He says that the David Ferry thing didn't lead any place. Okay. Let me ask a question. If you lie during an FBI interview, a sworn interview, and it's in what they call an exculpatory manner, all right, every prosecutor will tell you, and this includes people like Trey Gowdy, who used to be a congressman from South Carolina, but for 16 years was a prosecutor, and James Comey, who for 18 years was a prosecutor. And I actually wrote this down. It's in one of my articles. Okay. What do you do with exculpatory statements under oath that are false? And Comey replied, you refer them for prosecution. And Gowdy said, that's correct, because they reveal consciousness of guilt and also perhaps an intent to cover things up. David Ferry said he didn't know Oswald in his interview with the FBI. Garrison found 8 witnesses from the Civil Air Patrol who all testified to him that Oswald was in Ferry's troop, okay, in 1955. Now, when we talk about consciousness of guilt, to me, it doesn't get any worse than what David Ferry did. Right after Kennedy was killed, he was looking for evidence that would link him to Oswald. He did this 3 times in 6 days. He wanted to find out, number one, if Oswald had his library card. He called 2 people, okay, that week and said, did you see Oswald with my library card in the library? Then this is the capper. He was looking for the picture. I'm sure you're familiar with this, the famous Civil Air Patrol picture that PBS put on TV in 1993 that shows Oswald with Ferry. He was looking for that picture. Now, here's the capper. And I don't see how it gets any worse than this. That person who Ferry called trying to track down the picture, who had been in the Civil Air Patrol with Ferry, okay, he called the FBI. This is not BS. It's in the declassified files. He called the FBI. I think this is November 26th or 27th. He says, David Ferry, who I was in the Civil Air Patrol with, called me looking for a picture. Then he said, words of the effect, do you remember Oswald? I think he's looking for a picture that will depict him with Oswald because he wants to gather it up. Now, here's my question. With that kind of evidence, you had 2 charges against Ferry. Number one, he was lying to the FBI. Number two, he was trying to obstruct justice. In any real investigation, the FBI would have arrested him because those reveal, like I said, like Comey and Gowdy said, consciousness of guilt and an intent to cover something up. Okay. Well, nothing happened because the FBI and, well, not the FBI, Hoover was not interested. And neither was Tolson in solving this case. That's why the Warren Commission ended up the way it was.
So with regards to that question on this idea that Garrison was just a paranoid homophobe, and maybe Litwin is influenced by the fact that, I mean, he's a gay conservative. man. So, you know, his politics and his sexual orientation, maybe that influences him. What do you make of this claim that it was all driven by homophobia?
You know who started that? Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw started that in two ways. Okay. He was telling the FBI this in the middle of March, right after he was indicted, that Garrison was secretly a homosexual. Okay. And that he was somehow getting back at this secrecy and at him. Okay. Because he knew Shaw was a homosexual. There is no evidence I've ever seen that Jim Garrison was a homosexual. Secondly, he's the one who got James Kirkwood to write that horrible, awful book, American Grotesque, which said more or less the same thing, that Garrison didn't have any evidence against Shaw, and he did it because he wanted to persecute a homosexual. Both are utterly and completely false. I've been, like I said, through all of Garrison's memos. There is no memo I've ever seen that outlines any kind of homosexual conspiracy that Garrison ever took seriously. The first theory that Garrison went on was that he thought it was a right-wing paramilitary plot against, and there's actually memos that where he outlines this at first, okay? Then he shifted over in about April of 1967, yeah, about April or May of 1967. Then he gradually changed his mind and thought it was a CIA plot. There's never any evidence for what Litwin says actually happened. And in fact, since I've been in New Orleans five times, I've interviewed literally scores of people. Some of them are homosexuals. Some of them worked on Garrison's staff. Nobody ever said anything to me about this kind of factor in Garrison's investigation. And in fact, the only thing Bill Alford, who was an assistant DA, the only time this ever came up is that Bill told me that Garrison treated homosexual prostitution just like he would, you know, heterosexual prostitution. Okay. All right. And that was a crime, at least at that time and in that place. Okay. And that's the only time it ever came up in all the interviews. And when I say scores of people, I mean scores of people. I literally interviewed off the top of my head, either on the phone or in person, I probably interviewed 40 to 50 people in the New Orleans area. Okay. And that's being conservative. This issue never, ever came up. All right. And the way Litwin brings it up is,
Note here real quick that Ferry and Shaw were both gay men, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But Garrison never thought that was a motive for killing Kennedy. What Garrison thought the connection was, of course, was a Central Intelligence Agency, okay? Which it turns out they both lied about that too. Shaw lied his head off about not being part of the CIA. Okay, we have documents now that prove that he was lying. He by the way, not only did he say this to reporters that he was never associated, but you can see that on YouTube, that he was never with the CIA. He said this on the stand. He said this on the stand at his trial. Okay. Now, obviously, with the CIA doing this cover up about Shaw, okay, then Garrison could never prove that he was lying. Just like it was very hard for him to prove with this big cover up going on in New Orleans that Shaw used the alias of Bertrand. Okay. Although that's an accomplished fact now, because we know through the FBI documents that they themselves knew this. Okay.
So before I mentioned the thing about Ferry and Shaw, just for my listeners and their orientation, I think you were going to say something about, you had mentioned Garrison and how he dealt with things like prostitution. Were you going to add something there?
No. All I was going to say is that Garrison even prosecuted priests who tried to solicit, you know, homosexual encounters. Okay, which is a big difference between, say, for example, Harry Connick, who followed him. You know, I'm sure everybody knows that Harry Connick covered up one of the really the Dino Chanel thing, okay, which was one of the really the harbingers of this horrible Catholic Church scandal about homosexual molestation by priests in the United States. Okay, So that's the only thing that I ever encountered about this theme. Okay. And it's just not there. And the way that Litwin uses it is he uses people who are not trustworthy, like Bill Stuckey, for example. William Stuckey was a guy who conducted the famous interview between Oswald Butler and Bringier in New Orleans in, I think, August of 1963. All right. Well, he was an FBI CIA asset. All right. He was looking for ways to counter the Fair Play Cuba Committee in 1962. Okay. And so then, of course, that interview is very important in convicting Oswald in the public mind. So I don't consider Stuckey a very credible person, just like I don't consider people like Jack Gramillion, who was the governor of Louisiana, a famous segregationist governor who got angry at Garrison for his refusal to prosecute the famous Dombrowski case. This was where people like Guy Bannister and right-wing politicians wanted to shut down these Dombrowski's organization, which was an integration institute. And Garrison decided to take on the case just to make sure that it would not be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, because he knew it would be thrown out the Supreme Court, which it was. Okay. And so Gramillion didn't like that. Okay. All right. But Garrison did. And he tried to get back to him by saying that Jim Garrison was running a kind of ring of homosexual informants in New Orleans. Okay. Which there's no evidence for this at all, but Litwin prints it in his book. And by the way, let me say something about this. The reason this even came up is because New Orleans had a reputation at that time of being very kind of open about sexuality, okay, in that time, in that place, in the southern southeastern part of the United States, okay? And so that's why, okay, this whole idea even originated in the first place, okay? But let me bring up one point. Fred said that none of this led any place. Well, I've already shown that that's not true. But let's take a step beyond that, okay? Anybody who's seen JFK remembers the opening scene after the front credits, or actually during the front credits, okay? Because the opening scene is Eisenhower in the military-industrial complex speech. Then it cuts to this woman being thrown out of a car, okay, and taken to a hospital. And she's screaming that they're going to kill Kennedy. You've got to do something. These are serious guys, all right? Well, that happened. Rose Sheremy, who's the woman in that scene, predicted the Kennedy assassination in advance, all right? And she was picked up by a state police officer, Francis Frugier, all right? And she was taken to the Jackson State Hospital, all right? And on the way there, he talked to her. And she mentioned that the men she was with were going to kill Kennedy. And Frugier just, you know, she's higher than a kite. She's probably on a heroin trip or something. Okay. And he just excused it as nonsense. So he drops her off at the hospital, but she said it there too. She said it to two doctors, Victor Weiss and a guy named Wayne Owen, who was an intern there. All right. Then in the TV room, on the day of the assassination, when there was a news announcement about President Kennedy arriving in Dallas, she did it again. All right. So when Kennedy was assassinated, Frugier calls up the hospital, says, don't you let her go unless I talk to her first. Okay. And he wanted to give her to the Dallas police, but the Dallas police didn't want to hear from her, calls up the FBI. FBI didn't want to hear from her either. Okay. All right. So what happens is Garrison gets a phone call from another doctor at the hospital who had heard about this. And he's the one who calls in Frugier. Frugier goes to the bar that she was dropped off at with a whole series of pictures from Garrison's office. Mac Manuel, who was the bartender that night, remembered her because he remembered the guy she was with. He pointed out the two pictures. One of them was Sergio Arcacha Smith. The other one was Emilio Santana. Sergio Arcacha Smith shared an office right in the same building that Guy Bannister did. They were friends, okay? Frugier, during his House Select Committee interview, towards the end, he says to the investigators, by the way, did you hear that Sergio Arcacha Smith had drawings of the sewer system in Dealey Plaza in his apartment in Dallas? Doesn't go anywhere, huh? Okay. What do you call that? Okay. You know? And he says, I think it was Will Fritz that told me that. All right. All right. So there's just one lead. The Garrison, if it wasn't for Garrison, we wouldn't even know about Rose Jeremy.
So there's just a few more things I wanted to cover. I guess in terms of some of the names that came up with Fred Litwin, we sort of focused on specific characters. We talked about Clay Shaw. Was there anything else that we should know about Clay Shaw that we didn't get to so far?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, the Clinton-Jackson incident has now been, I mean, this is so solid today that it's kind of ridiculous, all right? Because with all the declassified files that the ARB made public through the Garrison investigation and the House Select Committee, other people have done research. I've been up there, the Clintons. I've been there two or three times, interviewed the surviving witnesses, okay? This incident happened. Should I describe what it was? Okay, all right. I would say at least 12 witnesses saw Oswald in a car with Shaw and Ferry. All right. The ostensible excuse is that he was trying to get a job at the Jackson State Hospital. All right. This incident took at least 2 days. All right. And he first went to see a barber named Edwin McGehee. He then went to see the local alderman, all right, who was Reeves Morgan. I managed to talk to both those people, plus Reeves Morgan's son and daughter, all right? Then he went to register to vote because Reeves Morgan advised him to do that if he wanted to get a job. What he didn't know, and what Sean Ferry didn't know, was there was a voter drive going on that day, okay? Because they wanted to try and integrate the two little towns there, all right? So even more witnesses saw him. But then when he talked to the registrar of voters, he told them, no, you don't have to register to vote to get a job over there. So he then went over to the hospital and he filled out an application. Three witnesses saw him inside the hospital filling out the application. And when he was asked, by the way, by the registrar of voters, if he knew anybody who worked at the hospital, he named two doctors who both worked at the hospital. How did Oswald know that? How did he know that those two guys worked at the hospital? Well, Manchester, who was the sheriff, grew suspicious of the car staying there for so long. So he went over and asked the driver to see his driver's license. He gave him the driver's license. Manchester testified at the House Select Committee in closed session that the driver's license said Clay Shaw International Trademark. Okay. He said, I didn't know, have any idea what the heck that was. Okay. But that's what he said. And the correspondent was on a driver's license. Okay. So there you have another lie by Shaw that he didn't know Oswald. Okay. So that's very, very solid today. And one more thing about Shaw. Before the leafleting incident in front of the International Trademark, because Oswald was leafleting on Canal Street and in front of the International Trademark, Carlos Quiroga, who was Carlos Bringier's right-hand man, Carlos Bringier ran the DRE, a CIA-affiliated Cuban exile group. Carlos Quiroga brang over a sheath of flyers, okay, to Oswald's apartment, all right? And it was before the International Trademark incident, okay? When Garrison cross-examined Quiroga under oath, I mean, I think it was a polygraph machine, he said, you knew that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee was really a shell group, right? You knew it really didn't exist. And Quiroga denied it, and the lie detector said that he was using deceptive criteria. Okay, so there's some more information about Clay Shaw, alias Clay Bertrand.
When I was talking to Lit Win, we also talked about Carrie Thornley.
Oh, God, Carrie Thornley.
I was going to say, I don't know as much about Carrie Thornley when it comes to the Kennedy assassination or the, you know, Garrison's investigation. I mainly know him for his sort of like pranksterism and the Discordianism stuff. And I always felt like he was, you know, sort of a guy that like kind of lost his mind. But maybe you can fill me in on the Garrison stuff, because I felt like I wasn't equipped to maybe be able to cover that with Fred Litwin as well as I wanted to.
Harry Thornley is a very important witness in the Kennedy assassination. And let me explain why. Carrie Thornley said that he knew Oswald in the Marine Corps, all right? And he knew him for about a period, about 3 months in Santa Ana, okay, when Oswald was stationed in California. He then got out of the Marine Corps. He moved to, he lived in Whittier, California, and moved to New Orleans. He moved to New Orleans right on the eve of the Bay of Pigs preparations in the spring of 1951, all right? He initially denied that he knew any of these people who were involved with Guy Bannister, with David Ferry, et cetera, okay? He also said that he never met Oswald when he was living in New Orleans at that time.
Was this why he was charged? I think he was charged for perjury, right?
Well, I'm going to explain why Garrison did this. Okay. And so he then goes to Washington and he becomes the number one prime military witness against Lee Harvey Oswald. Most of the military witnesses in the Warren Commission did very brief one paragraph descriptions of their relationship with Oswald that were very nondescript, all right? Some of them aren't even a half page long. Carrie Thornley was on the stand for 33 pages. They gave him a formal deposition, and there's no doubt of all the service witnesses, he was a guy who incriminated Oswald by far the most. He was the one who blasted him as being mentally unstable, as being a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist, as being a person who wanted to stamp his imprint on history, okay? And this was the way that he did it, all right? Now, David Lifton and Carrie Thornley began to write some memos to Garrison, all right? And Garrison read these things, and he thought, I think there's something wrong here. For example, about Renee Heindel, who was a guy in the Marine Corps with Oswald at Santa Ana, saying that Thornley spoke Russian with this guy. And when Garrison brought Heindel in for questioning, he said, Mr. Garrison, I don't even speak Russian. So I don't know who's saying this stuff about me. And so this is what began to perk his ears up about Thornley, all right? And the thing that really puzzled Garrison was that he found it very hard to believe that Thornley did not know Oswald in New Orleans in the summer of 1963, because they associated in the same circles. Thornley knew all these people. He knew Carlos Bringier. He was in Bannister's office. Okay. Alan Campbell, one of the investigators for Bannister, was talking to Thornley on the day of the assassination. All right. And he later admitted all this stuff, that he did know all these people, you know, because for the Warren Commission, he was essentially the, you know, he was a guy playing the piano in the bordello, didn't know what was going on upstairs. Well, later on, he actually admitted all this stuff. All right. Now, before he did his gig for the Warren Commission, he went to the newspapers and did a story for them, the New Orleans State Sun, and said the same thing. If you read his Warren Commission testimony, there's a very revealing part of it. He says on the night of the assassination, he just happened to be at WDSU TV station. And Albert Jenner, who's the examiner, says words of the effect, "Oh, okay. Now, I would have asked him, what were you doing there? Were you taking a leak or something? And that was the closest place you could find a bathroom?" You know, never asked him the follow-up question. It turns out Garrison found a witness who walked down to the TV station that night, a guy named Cliff Hall, worked for a radio broadcaster. He said Thornley was there because he was doing an interview. And it was about Oswald. And they just happened to be playing the tape of Carlos Bringier and Ed Butler debating Oswald. And he was speaking of Oswald in the very same terms that he later would talk about with the Warren Report. So then him and Thornley went to get a drink afterwards. And he said, "So you did know Oswald in New Orleans?" And he goes, Thornley admitted, "Yeah." He goes, "How well did you know him?" "I knew him fairly well." He also told two other witnesses that Garrison found that he knew Oswald was not a communist. So we get back to the question with Thornley. Any responsible prosecutor is going to look askance at exculpatory statements that turn out to be false. Okay. The natural question is, why is the guy lying? You know, and if he's lying, then is it an innocent lie? With Thornley, it wasn't an innocent lie. Okay. He was right in the middle of this whole network. Okay, that was using Oswald. Just ask yourself this. Just ask yourself this. In 1961, before he moves to New Orleans, he's writing a novel about Oswald. Okay?
Idle Warriors. Yeah.
Right. In 1961, in New Orleans, who else is using Oswald's name in a fictitious manner? Guy Bannister. He's sending these people to Bolton Ford to buy these Jeeps for use in the Bay of Pigs. So here's my question. That is a cosmic coincidence that the only other guy in the United States who's using Oswald in a fictional manner suddenly goes down to New Orleans and he shows Guy Bannister his manuscript, who's also using Oswald's name in a fictitious manner. Okay, if that's a coincidence, it's too big of a coincidence for me to swallow. Kerry Thornley was hiding something and about his involvement. He lied to the Warren Commission. He lied to Jim Garrison. Okay, and he ran away from the House Select Committee. Okay, and by the way, when he was doing these lies, you know, people always plead that he was so poor. When he was hiding out from Garrison in Florida, because I know a guy who was working for Garrison at the time, said, "Jim, really funny about Thornley. He's supposed to be so poor, right? He owned two homes and he had two cars in Florida. I saw his place in Tampa. It was a pretty nice house on a 1 acre spread in Tampa." When they tried to track him down for the House Select Committee, they listed his address because he did meet with them once. I went to look at the address, okay? 5-bedroom house, okay, 2 baths on an 1.5-acre lot, okay? So I said, well, Kerry Thornley might have been poor, but it's a funny coincidence at the time that he's being investigated by Garrison and the House Select Committee, he sure had access to some nice homes. Okay. Again, that's too much of a coincidence for me to swallow. All right.
So last two things I wanted to cover. I know we've gone a little bit over time, and I thank you for that. Firstly, I guess the response that maybe some people, maybe Fred Litwin himself will have if they hear this is, well, you know what? You can say all you want that there was a conspiracy and it wasn't just Oswald that took out JFK. But where's the smoking gun? Where's the smoking gun? Where's the document that says we did it? How do you respond to that?
Look, first of all, these guys don't write things down when they're plotting to get rid of somebody. Okay. It's very difficult to find, pre-felony evidence, the CIA. But I would say, the strongest piece of evidence is that today we can expose that CE-399 is a fabrication. Do I have to explain what CE-399
is? Yeah, just briefly if you could.
CE-399 is the so-called magic bullet, okay, which was supposed to have gone through two people, making seven wounds in two people, smashing two bones in John Conley, and emerging virtually unscathed on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital, where it was found by Daryl Tomlinson, given to O.P. Wright, and then given to the Secret Service, and then landing in the FBI headquarters at night. Okay. Through the work of Gary Aguilar and Ting Thompson and the late John Hunt, we can prove now that that was either switched or it was faked all along. And let me briefly explain why. All right. That bullet was supposed to have been given to Elmer Lee Todd, an FBI agent, at the White House at, I think, 8:45 on the evening of the November. And we know this because we have a receipt. The evening of November 22nd, 1963, was handed to him by James Rowley, chief of the Secret Service, given to Elmer Lee Todd, okay? And then he drove down to the FBI headquarters. He was an FBI agent and gave it to Frazier, who was the technical guy on ballistics for the Robert Frazier for the FBI. Well, here's the problem. Frazier already had the bullet. In his notes that anybody can see at the National Archives, he wrote down received stretcher bullet at 7:30. How could he have received a stretcher bullet if Elmer Lee Todd had not given it to him yet? Let's say it must have taken at least 15 minutes to drive there. So he had it an hour and a half before Elmer Lee Todd gave it to him. Now, here's the consciousness of guilt. Hoover knew that this was a problem. Because in his report, CE-2011, I think, commission exhibit, it's a document in the Warren Commission, it says Elmer Lee Todd initialed the bullet. It's right there in black and white for anybody to see. Well, guess what? That's a damn lie. Because John Hunt actually had the pictures of the bullet. David Mantic actually had the actual bullet in his hands. There are no initials of Elmer Lee Todd on that bullet. Okay? So CE-399, they basically had us chasing, like a cat chasing its tail for all these years. It was never meant to be a credible piece of evidence, and it isn't. And so you got to ask yourself, who planted the bullet and why? And how did they know to match it up to that rifle?
Now, the other thing, I'm assuming the other objection that people always give when it comes to the Kennedy assassination is, the CIA doesn't go over the head of the president, much less plot a coup where the president is assassinated by elements of the CIA. How would you respond to that? And do we have examples maybe of when the CIA has done something without maybe the president being fully aware of it?
Mike Swanson did a book called The War State. Okay.
Mike's a sponsor of the show, actually.
Oh, he is? I didn't know that. So that's not a setup for you. Okay. In his book, he went through and did a categorical analysis, okay, of CIA operations. And he came to the conclusion that 25% of them were not authorized. They were not authorized to do this, okay? All right, in other words, what mostly happened is that they started something, found out that they couldn't do it, and so they went ahead and did another operation to try and boost their chances for success without going back to the White House or the NSC and getting permission to do it. All right. In the case of Kennedy, all right, he actually called up Paris during the attempt to overthrow de Gaulle. And he talked to the French ambassador there and said, look, I'm not in on this thing. Okay. The CIA does stuff that they don't tell me about. Okay, so if de Gaulle needs my help, I'll be glad to send the 7th Fleet into a port. Okay, but I'm not involved with this at all. All right, and so by the way, he had that experience more than once, because I talked about the assassination of Lumumba, okay, which he didn't find out about till February 13th. Then there's the Castro plots, in which the CIA itself admitted, it's right there in black and white, that we had no presidential authorization for these plots to kill Fidel Castro. And by the way, those went on from 1959 to 1965. So in other words, there were three presidents. You had Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, that they never had any permission to do this in the first place, right? So there's several examples for you.
And we should have mentioned this earlier, and I feel like this was the part of the interview with Fred that sort of got under my skin, actually. You know, I think Fred really wanted to paint this picture of these crazy left-wingers are the reason that we have conspiracy theories today. You know, he's sort of trying to say, oh, the Mark Lanes of the world, the Jim Garrisons, look, this is like the prototype to Donald Trump and QAnon. And
look, this whole right-wing conspiracy phenomenon did not start in 1966 with Mark Lane. It goes back much further than that. Okay. It really began in the mid 50s over two things. Number one, the struggle over integration and the fear of communism. All right. People like Roy Cohn, all right, urged it and egged it on until it formed something called the John Birch Society. The John Birch Society had a completely different view of the Kennedy assassination, for example. They thought Oswald did it, okay, for the Russians, all right, and that Kennedy was actually offering himself up to further the communist cause. They thought that Eisenhower was a Manchurian candidate. That's how far right these people were, all right? And so then, of course, the John Birch Society burst into the American scene in 1964 at the Goldwater Convention. They had a very powerful effect. And in fact, they published a book to try and let Goldwater win called A Texan Looks at Lyndon. It was by this John Birch Society guy who hated the Democrats. So he wrote this book about Lyndon Johnson that the John Birch Society promoted. Guess what? It sold 5 million copies. Okay. Very popular book. So then what happened is that right-wing movement after the Goldwater thing eventually took over the Republican Party, you know, and Richard Hofstadter, he looked at it all as a joke. He's supposed to be a historian. He thought, oh, these guys, because Goldwater was defeated, they're not going anywhere, and it's the paranoid angle in American politics. Well, that was completely wrong, because when Ronald Reagan got into office, that sprung open the doors for these extreme right-wingers, all right? And they flourished with people like Pat Buchanan, okay, et cetera, and the union between the Republican Party and the Christian right, people like Jerry Falwell, okay? And now under Trump, they flourish. They've essentially, you know, the QAnon thing is now looked upon as a legitimate organization or a belief system. And see, this is the big difference. The thing that people like Mark Lane were doing, that people like Sylvia Marr were doing, that people like Tink Thompson was doing, they were doing database studies of evidence and testimony based upon the Warren Commission volumes themselves, the 26 volumes and the report. They came to a very simple conclusion, and that was this. The evidence in the volumes didn't match what was being said in the report, and it's all cut and dried. QAnon is not an evidentiary testimonial. Look, when you start breaking into a pizza parlor, okay, trying to shoot up the place in the basement because you think Hillary Clinton is running a child molestation center, when in fact there is no basement at that pizza parlor, that is not evidence-based, okay?
Well, I was just going to add, too. I think that a lot of people will say, well, a lot of QAnoners believe in, you know, the deep state killed Kennedy. But I feel like they're following the footsteps of people like Roger Stone or, you know, back in the early 2000s. One thing I had noticed with like the InfoWars and Alex Jones crowd is they were really honing in on this idea that, oh, it was just LBJ that did it. It was all LBJ that did Kennedy in. And I feel like in a lot of ways, the right wing, the sort of fringe right, clinged to the Kennedy assassination long after the fact and sort of created a new narrative where it was all LBJ's fault.
My take on that is this. I think Alex Jones uses the Kennedy assassination to give himself a patina of respectability. Okay. You know, that because there are a lot of credible people who came to that conclusion. But what he does, he twists it all around, okay, and says that it was really Lyndon Johnson who killed Kennedy. Roger Stone said the same thing, all right? And Roger Stone is a very common guest on Alex Jones's show.
And also, if you read Roger Stone's book on the Kennedy assassination, basically a lot of it is just him attacking Kennedy. Oh, look at all the affairs. Look at meth and all this other stuff. He did speed. Oh,
yeah. Oh, when I appeared on a show with him, what he said was that Kennedy actually ran to the right of Nixon, okay, in the 1960 election. All right. Well, that might have been true in some respects, but if you look at the speeches, Kennedy was talking about civil rights in the campaign of 1960. He was talking about raising the minimum wage in 1960. I didn't see Nixon doing very much of that. All right. So, you know, I believe that, you know, these guys, you know, they're in a situation that I think they took advantage of. Okay. And the thing is, now they're stuck with it. Okay. They're stuck with it. You know, Alex Jones, I don't know if you saw this, but in an interview we did, he said words to the effect, I wish I would have never met Donald Trump. Okay. You know, that kind of thing. You know, Trump, it's really, I believe it's one of the worst things that he did is that he actually gave those people respectability to the point that there's two of them in Congress now. There's that Angela Green and there's that Lauren Boebert. Okay. I mean, that is just, I mean, to have those people in Congress is scary. You know, it really is. I mean, look, this country has some very serious problems.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, with the QAnon stuff, bringing it back to the Birchers, I mean, I think if you were to really dig deep into what QAnon believes, when they say, oh, the CIA killed Kennedy, they're basically saying, well, these communists in the CIA, they think it was all communists. I don't think Mark Lane or, you know, these other people thought that.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, that's one thing that those people never talk about is Kennedy's foreign policy. Okay. You know, and how it diverged so much, you know, which is really kind of weird because that's what people like me think happened, that Kennedy was just getting so far out there in 1963, you know, that these guys decided, you know, we have to get rid of this guy. And by the way, I was just talking to a couple of people in the last few weeks, and you know, that's essentially what they said, that people in the Pentagon, people in the CIA, you know, essentially decided that, you know, this is going way too far. You know, and if you take a look at what Kennedy was doing by the fall of 1963, you know, it is, you know, comparatively speaking, it is pretty much out there. You know, so that's what I believe happened. I'm not saying that LBJ didn't know about it. Okay. I'm not saying that he wasn't part of the cover up. He certainly as hell was part of the cover up. Okay. You know, but by the way, one other thing that I want to mention about his interview. I think it was you who said this, that these conspiracy people think that somehow if we solved all these cases, that things would improve in the United States.
I did say that. And if you want to rip into me, go ahead.
you did say that. I'm glad you admitted it. All right. Okay. The problem isn't that. The problem is this, that there was no justice done at the time. There was no serious investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. There was no real investigation of Malcolm X. There was no real investigation of the murder of Martin Luther King. There was no real investigation of the Robert Kennedy assassination. They were all in some way, shape, or form cover-ups. If you add those four assassinations together and you take a look at where America was in 1963 and where it ended up in 1971 and 72, 73, there was a huge change in this country. I know because I lived with it. I lived towards it, okay? It was essentially the disintegration of our belief in our government was saying to us. That's what happened. And if you look at, there was a book that was published by, who's that, Mark, the guy who wrote The Coming Republican Majority. He used to be a Nixon strategist, okay? He wrote a book in which he charted the disbelief in government.
How Kevin it's gone. Phillips.
Yeah, that's it. Kevin Phillips, that's it. He wrote a book and he put a graph in there. And it went from 1960 to where 70% of the people believed in what the government was saying and doing to, I think, 1990, where it was like 19% of the people believed in what. The biggest drop off in that chart is 1964. The year that the Warren Report was issued, okay? I'm sorry, again, you're asking me to swallow a huge coincidence, which I'm not gonna swallow, okay? The whole idea that America was a force for good in the world, that it really tried to do something good for its people, that's all been dissipated, okay? And the biggest problem I see with that is those four assassinations that took place within 5 years.
Now, before we started recording, I felt like this was important too, if we could just cover it briefly. I had mentioned to you in my email that one thing that always did get me about Mark Lane and also L. Fletcher Prouty was their involvement with Willis Carto and the Liberty Lobby. And I knew some of Carto's people when I was younger, and they were trying to get younger people involved. And luckily I moved very much left and didn't get involved in that really. Could you comment on that whole issue that people like to bring up when it comes to Mark Lane and the Liberty Lobby and Willis Carto, who, you know, Carto was very far right for people that don't know, and basically just a horrible anti-Semite, but you had some thoughts on that and I wanted to give you some space to talk about it.
Okay. This is what I know about it. Okay. First of all, Prouty never gave them permission to go ahead and use his name, you know, on, I think it was their advisory group or something. All right. And he did not know that they were tied into this Institute for Historical Review or what that thing was. Okay. it's basically that group, I think, is in San Diego. All right. And they're essentially denying the Holocaust. All right. So they asked to reprint The Secret Team. All right. And Fletcher told Leno Sanek, who was a close confidant of his, he didn't know that that is what they were all about. Okay, but he did not withdraw the book because I think he told Len words to the effect, look, every once in a while, okay, you get something good coming out of something bad. Okay, so every once in a while, say Random House might print a good book. All right, so that's kind of the way I feel about the reprint of The Secret Team. He was asked to do two speeches at the Holocaust Museum in Washington. Fletcher Prouty was asked to do two speeches there. So how on earth could the guy be, why would they do that? Okay. It's just not true. It's not accurate.
We also right. mentioned something about John McAdams, who's another big
JFK. Oh yeah. John McAdams went through, and I think we all know he passed away a few weeks ago, and he was pretty bad on the JFK case, if you ask me. A very fierce critic of the Warren Commission critics and also of Oliver Stone, all right? And Prouty, he said he went through all the writings he could get by Fletcher Prouty, all right? And he says, I can't find any trace of anti-Semitism in any of his writings, okay? And he actually admitted that, all right? Okay, now, I don't know that much about Mark Lane and Willis Carteau. I do know he defended them in the E. Howard Hunt lawsuit. Okay. But I don't know that much about his association with Carteau. But Mark Lane was Jewish. All right. So I very doubt that he would be in that particular, but let me make a distinction, which I talked about you before we started taping this. Okay. There's a difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, okay, which we tend to essentially brush off in this country. And if you're an anti-Zionist, then they automatically think that you're an anti-Semite. Now, I don't think that way, okay? And I have a lot of criticisms about the modern state of Israel, okay, which, you know, you can't really say that much about in the United States because you get attacked as being anti-Semitic.
So I think the last point that it may be useful to address here is the question of declassified documents. Do you want to comment on that, Jim?
All right. Now we have all this great information that's to be classified by the ARB. The American people deserve to see these facts for what they are. All right. And by the way, I don't think you guys mentioned there's still 15,400 pages redacted in full or in part on the Kennedy assassination. If you remember, Donald Trump was so glad next week, all the documents will be declassified. All right. Well, he didn't do it. He put it off for 3 years. Change of presidents.
Jefferson Morley made a really interesting point when I had him on the show. He said, you know, I don't really care if you think Oswald did it or if you think the CIA did it. What matters is if there's nothing to hide, why can't we have the documents now? And I mean, I think regardless of one's view on the Kennedy assassination, we should have full transparency about it by now.
Yes, yes. And I totally agree with that.
Well, I want to thank you again, Jim, for spending some time with us on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work? Kennedy's and King, right?
Yeah, kennedysandking.com is my website. By the way, I just reviewed Mr. Swanson's book, Why the Vietnam War, which I liked, okay? And so we have three categories there. We have research essays, we have book reviews and film reviews, and we have the latest news in the JFK case. So tune in there if you want to know what's going on in both the JFK case, all three of them, MLK and RFK. And we do as much as we can on Malcolm X.
And a review recently, a friend of the show, Aaron Good, wrote on Kennedy's and King about the new Adam Curtis movie.
Well, Aaron Good. He was on your show?
Yes.
Okay. Aaron Good is doing part two. Okay. For me right now. Okay. And I'm going to contribute something in there about how Adam Curtis got snookered by Carrie Thornley. Okay. So that should be very, by the way, that's the highest rated article at the website right now. It's by far, it's not even close. It's by far the highest rated article at the website. And in fact, I'll say this. It's the highest rated article that we have had at Kennedy's and King since I wrote the obituary for James McCord. All right. It's the highest rated article in over 2 years. So I guess a lot of people want to know, how did Adam Curtis come up with such a crappy show? And I guess they like the fact that Aaron is exposing it. He's come a long way since part one and two of The Power of Nightmares.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jim DiEugenio. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Ben, Catherine, Brian, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15 doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.